In this Dharma talk, Lama Karma Chutsu teaches from the book What Makes You Not a Buddhist and discusses the four seals that will tell you whether you are truly on a Buddhist path. The Open Awareness Buddhist Center is a 501c3 nonprofit organization and exists solely upon the generous donations of people just like you. If you find this recording helpful, please visit our site at www.miamibuddhism.com and make a donation so that we can maintain and expand our Dharma Center. And now, Lama Karma Chutsu.
The reason that this book is called What Makes You Not a Buddhist is because there are, you know, people are always asking you, well, what does that mean that you're a Buddhist? You know, and have different ideas about, yeah, there they go. Okay. Have different ideas about what that actually means. So there are these four seals, S-E-A-L-S, four seals of practice. Well, they're just four seals. And really, if you can't get any of these, all four of these, into your continuum, you would not be able to say, yes, I am truly a Buddhist. So these four are, the first one is all compounded things are impermanent. That's an easy one. We're talking about things. Everybody knows about things. We know everything comes is put together through different causes and conditions. Everything is made up of atoms. We know that if something is compounded and comes together through causes and conditions, it's also going to fall apart through causes and conditions. And it will change because of causes and conditions. So that one doesn't take a whole lot of explanation. But the second one is all emotions are pain. Now, emotions, I think that here in the Tibetan word would be nyunmong. And nyunmong sort of means, it can be said to mean, sort of that which tortures you.
Nyunmong.
But it does mean afflicted states, states that afflict you so and take you away from being in a state of peace. So that's what I'm going to talk about tonight, partly because the first part of the chapter is such a lovely story about Siddhartha. And since some of you are not even Buddhists yet, maybe you are and you just don't meditate, but you're new meditators, so I'm going to read this little story at the beginning, which is I like. So it says, through many years of contemplation and penance, Siddhartha remained steadfast in his determination to find the root cause of suffering and to ease his own suffering and the suffering of others. He headed to Magadha in the heart of India to continue his meditation. Along the way, he met a grass seller named Sathya, who offered him a handful of kusha grass. So instead, in the Indian culture, kusha grass is considered a cleanser, a cleansing substance. So Siddhartha recognized this as being auspicious, the sign that he was given, this kusha grass. So he decided to stop his journey and meditate right there. And he found a place to sit on the flat stones under a nearby tree called Ficus religiosa, which I think was not named until after this happened. But anyway, and he used the kusha grass as a mat to sit upon. And silently, this was his vow at this point. Now, he'd already been through years of meditating in the forest, but this was what he said. This body may rot, I may disintegrate into the dust, but until I find the answer, I will not rise. So as Siddhartha sat in contemplation beneath the tree, he did not go unnoticed. Mara, the king of the demons, so this word Mara in Sanskrit literally means demon. Mara, the king of the demons, heard Siddhartha's vow and sensed the strength of his resolve. Mara grew sleepless, for he knew that within Siddhartha existed the potential to throw Mara's domain into chaos. But being a strategic warrior, he sent five of his most beautiful daughters to distract and seduce the Prince Siddhartha. As the girls set out, they had full confidence in their seductive talents, but as they approached the meditating Siddhartha, their beauty began to vanish. They withered and aged. They grew warts, and a stench rose from their skin, and Siddhartha did not move. The dejected girls returned to their father, who was furious. How dare anyone refuse his daughters? In his rage, Mara summoned his retinue, a great army furnished with every imaginable weapon, and the army attacked in full force. But to their dismay, all the arrows, spears, stones, and catapults aimed at Siddhartha transformed into a rain of flowers as soon as they came within reach of their target. After many long hours of unsuccessful warfare, Mara and his army were exhausted and defeated. Finally, Mara came to Siddhartha and with all his diplomacy tried to talk him into giving up his quest. Siddhartha said he could not give up after so many lifetimes of trying. And Mara asked, "How can we be so sure you have been struggling for so long?" And Siddhartha answered, "I don't need validation. The earth is my witness." And with this, he touched the ground. So his hand went over his knee and his fingers touched the ground. And the earth shook and Mara evaporated into thin air. Thus, Siddhartha found liberation and became a Buddha. That means one who is awakened. He had discovered the path to end suffering at its very root, not only for himself, but for all people. The place of his final battle against Mara is now called Bodh Gaya, and the tree under which he sat is called the Bodhi tree. And this is the story that Buddhist mothers have told their children for many generations in Tibet. So this is the story of that last night, the last watch before Siddhartha actually became the Buddha. So then he goes on to, Rinpoche goes on to talk about how we define suffering and happiness, and especially how do we define personal happiness. So he says it's not appropriate to ask a Buddhist what is the meaning of life or what is the purpose of life, because the question suggests that somewhere out there, perhaps in a cave or on a mountaintop, an ultimate purpose actually exists. The question suggests that if we could decode the secret by studying with living saints, reading books, or mastering esoteric practices. If the question is based on an assumption that eons ago someone or some god designed a diagram of the purpose, then it is a theistic question. But Buddhists don't believe that there is an almighty creator, and they don't have this concept that the purpose of life has been or needs to be decided and defined. A more appropriate question to ask a Buddhist is simply, what is life? From our understanding of impermanence, the answer should be obvious. Here it is. Life is a big array of assembled phenomena, and thus life is impermanent. So it is a constant shifting, a collection of transitory experiences. And although myriad life forms exist, one thing we all have in common is that no living being wishes to suffer. We all want to be happy. From presidents and billionaires to hardworking ants and bees and butterflies. So the definitions of suffering and happiness differ a great deal among these life forms, even within the relatively small human realm. The definition of suffering for some is the definition of happiness for others. For some humans, being happy means just managing to survive. For others, it means owning 700 pairs of shoes. There are those who find happiness in having a likeness of David Beckham tattooed on their biceps. Sometimes the price is the life of another being, as when one's happiness depends on getting hold of a chicken thigh. Some consider a gentle tickle of a feather erotic, while others prefer whips and chains. King Edward VIII preferred to marry an American divorcee instead of wearing the crown of the British Empire. So, and then he says, even within one individual, this changes also. The concept of happiness is changing always. With every experience we have, the concept of happiness changes and the concept of suffering changes. Right? Mm-hmm. As in when we get sick. All of a sudden, our concept of happiness is totally changed because all we want is to be better and then we'll be happy. And when then you get better and the illness is totally gone, and you find another thing. He goes, wait a second, I got really happy. I'm happy I'm not sick, but I'm not really happy. And we keep going through these things and trying to discover what it is that makes us happy, what our happiness consists of, and it is always something outside of ourselves. This is where the Buddhist thing does a switch up on what we call samsara. And that is that there is no lasting happiness to be found in your experiences of other phenomena. That's not where your happiness is going to be found. If you find a happiness in that, and many people do, it will not be long lasting. Even if it lasts an entire lifetime, at the end, there's always an end. You know, so you could be married to the perfect person for 55 years. One of my sisters has been. And I really dread the day that one or the other of them passes away, because it's going to be hell. The other person is not going to know where they are anymore, because that person defined their world so totally. So their, you know, right now their concept of happiness is one thing, but if something happens to one of them, their concept of happiness is going to change radically, and their whole experience of suffering is also going to change radically. So then what do we do as Buddhists? What do we do about this? Well, the main thing that we do is understand that outer phenomena and our experiences of them are not where we can find lasting happiness. The place where we can find lasting happiness, something that I wouldn't even call happiness, maybe lasting contentment, lasting peace, lasting bliss, is only in our own minds. This is one of the reasons why we meditate, to begin to open up, not to just the channels so the airs can move freely, but to open up the mind to its full potential. And it's the full potential of any mind is the potential for omniscience. Does everybody know what omniscience means?
Probably
no. Not really?
Probably
Omni means
no.
All.
No, I know what it means, but I said...
Omniscience means to know all.
No, I know, but I'm not sure everyone knows. So I'm glad you defined it.
Well, at least I had someone to look at it next time. But that's what omniscience means. It means to know everything. Omniscience implies that it's beyond just a state of knowledge, that there is a wisdom and a realization involved in that, so that you know you have a not just, you don't know just how things appear to be, but how they truly are. So the way everything appears to us is the way that we take them to be. We think that the way things appear is the way they actually are. You know, like this house has been here for, 70-some years, right? So people in the neighborhood think, oh, well, this is a house that's been there for all these years. This house is permanent. It's not. It could be here for another 150 years, and it's still not going to be permanent. Just like we are discovering that the earth and the way the earth functions and the way the climate is on the earth can change, and we can make a change. We can be the cause and the condition for the entire earth and its weather to change. So We have this idea, however, that one of the reasons I think that this has come about is because we thought that there was no way that we could change it. We don't think about really what we're doing. It's just, I can do that. Oh, we can do that. Let's do it. You know? But now I think we've gotten to the point where we try to assess what the results will be before we do it. But often we don't, you know? I think that it's still kind of, I guess you could say it's an annoyance to me that science will spend billions and trillions of dollars on experiments and machines and spaceships and stuff, but no one can figure out how to feed starving children in the Sudan. You can't figure it out. They just cannot figure it out.
They just don't want to spend the money.
Exactly.
They can figure it out.
Exactly. But how many billions of dollars did they spend to build that thing to find the Higgs something or other particle?
Higgs boson. Higgs boson.
Yeah, Higgs boson particle. You see, so what one person's idea of happiness is to have this machine. And as long as he can literally get a lot of other people and governments and associations and scientific things to go along with the program, he'll get his money and he'll get his machine and he can play with it forever until he dies. The machine won't do him any good when he dies, but, you know, that's what he wants. Whereas another person over here is saying, but if I could only have half of that money, I could feed all these starving children and I could set up clinics so that these people would not die of cholera anymore and blah, 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 and all of this other stuff, right? But no, there's not enough money. So you see, one person's happiness really does globally affect others. It really does. And so when we think in terms of personal and individual happiness, if we only consider our own and don't consider that of others, then we might not be doing as much good as we could in this world because we are very powerful. Someone said, I think it was Marianne Williamson, who said it's not that you don't think you can do it, it's that you think you're so powerful, too powerful. So you don't go there. Something like that. That was really, I badly said, sorry. She said it so eloquently. If anybody knows that quote, tell me what it was. But basically, we do not think in terms of how much we change things. And therefore, we have a feeling that we can't really change ourselves. And therefore, we don't try. And therefore, doesn't happen. Any questions yet? What? Laughs, but no questions? Okay, so what about institutionalized definitions of happiness? I think we're talking about that a bit here too. Long before he reached the famous spot in Bodh Gaya, Siddhartha sat under a different tree for 6 years. He grew emaciated on a diet of a few grains of rice and a few drops of water. He didn't bathe, he didn't cut his nails, and thus he became a model for his colleagues, the other spiritual seekers with whom he was practicing, who thought that this kind of extreme asceticism was something that was going to allow them to reach enlightenment. So he was so disciplined that the local cowherd children who tickled his ears with grass and blew trumpets in his face never succeeded in stirring him. But then one day, after many years of extreme deprivation, he realized, this is not right. This is an extreme path, just another trap, like the courtesans, the peacock gardens, and the jeweled spoons that he had had as a prince in the palace. And he decided to rise from that state of penance and bathe in the nearby Nairanjana River. To the utter shock of his companions, he even accepted some fresh milk from a milkmaid named Sujata. It is believed that they deserted Siddhartha, thinking he was a bad moral influence. hadn't even eaten a meal yet, but he was a bad moral influence, and that being with him would impede their practice. So one can understand why these ascetics deserted him for breaking his vows. Humans have always tried to find happiness not only through material gain, but through spiritual means as well. Much of world history revolves around religion. Religions unite people with their illuminating paths or codes of conduct. Loving your neighbor, practicing generosity, meditation, fasting, making sacrifices. But those seemingly helpful principles can become extreme and become dogma, which causes people to feel unnecessary guilt and low self-esteem. So one of the things that, if you are interested in the Buddhist path, try to make sure that that's not what you're doing personally in your own mind. Buddhism is not about dogma. It's about breaking open. And if you decide that you need to have some lists of virtuous activities and not virtuous activities, if you need to have some guidelines about other things, if you need to have these things, take them, have them, but don't make them something concretized in your mind so that you can never see beyond them, because ultimately it won't work. Okay? So it's, we can't, if you decide that there are some rules and some laws, like these four seals, if you would take these four seals and say, oh, well, you know, this is the way I've got to be then, you know, and turn it into dogma versus something that can teach you how to open up to be a Buddha, if you do that, then what's going to happen is that it will delay your path. It will delay your realization. Any time that we reify or solidify or concretize ideas, as a matter of fact, almost any time that we say, I believe, you've immediately shut down all possibilities other than what I believe. Mm-hmm. And so on the Buddhist path, it's another kind of a balancing act, where yes, you take the teachings and you use them and you find the benefit in them through your own contemplation. If you find no benefit in a teaching, throw it away and use the rest that's there. Use what works for you. I think sometimes, I don't know if it's Westerners or if this also happened in Asia, because I wasn't brought up there and I didn't practice there very much for very long periods of time. But we do have a tendency here to do that very thing, to learn these things and then say, well, this is what I believe, and then you don't have to think anymore. But that's not what this path is about. This path is about saying, if I think I believe this, I really better start working hard on this and really understand what it actually is, how I am relating to it, how I'm reifying it, how I'm solidifying it. And then if I'm solidifying things in my mind, I'm just building more constructs that sooner or later I'm going to have to blast apart in order to realize anything about the nature of mind. So one has to be really, really careful. And these four seals are beautiful. The other two seals are all things, all phenomena, have no inherent existence. And the fourth one is nirvana is beyond concepts. So all the reification that you're doing, all of the solidifying that you're doing, all the concretizing that you're doing of your own ideas or the ideas that you've gotten from books is not going to get you to nirvana, because they're all concepts. They might help you for a while, but you have to always be willing to drop them. If you're not willing to drop them, then you've really got something to work on there. You've got to really watch it carefully. It can be a very, very... This is one of the things that literally can turn a beautiful Dharma center into a personality cult. And I've seen it happen. It doesn't work. That's not Dharma. That's not Buddhism. That's not the practices that the Buddha taught. It has nothing to do with that. Okay? So it's just a word to the wise that if you're going to reach nirvana, you have to be willing to let any concept go. anything. And the first one, of course, that you need to work on is the concept of the self. Because that's the one that causes the most trouble, sadly. Okay, so all compounded things are impermanent is the first seal. All emotions are pain is the second. All things, all phenomena have no inherent existence. Does everyone know what that means? Oh, okay. Inherent, if something inherently existed, it would exist on its own. It would... they're going, yeah, I'm sorry. This is my entertainment. I don't even have a television. And while I have a computer, I stay away from it as much as I can, but these two entertain me all the time. So anyway, now I'll get back to this. If a thing, a phenomenon, had inherent existence, it would never come about through causes and conditions. It would always have been. It would never change, and it would never go away. Does everybody get that? If something inherently exists, it can't change. It exists inherently, on its own. It doesn't need you. If you were inherently existent, the fur is flying up here. I don't know if you all see it, but if you were inherently existent, you would not change from this moment. You would always be the way you are. Nothing would change. You wouldn't get older. You wouldn't have another thought. Nothing. You would never eat a meal. You'd never have sex. It would be all over. You would inherently exist. Nothing could possibly change. Do you understand then what inherent existence really means? It means the potential for anything else is lost. So think about the phenomena that you experience. Like, you know, in the next few weeks, look at the things that you experience and say, ah, does that have inherent existence? Like the house, we just talked about the house not being permanent. The house has no inherent existence whatsoever. It came together through causes and conditions, through design, through a lot of people working, through... I mean, they built a very nice house, but, you know, it can't always be here. It's always changing. Things break.
You still have to fix the plumbing.
We still had to fix the plumbing to the tune of $15,000. But, you know, that's probably not the worst that could have happened either. So anyway, the house has no inherent existence, and neither do I. I hope you're all happy about the fact that you have no inherent existence, which means that you can change. Which means, since you are able to change, you can actually attain enlightenment, because you have mind, you have the potential. And not only that, attaining enlightenment doesn't mean that you acquire something that you don't already have. You already have enlightened mind. It's already there. And it's covered up with a whole bunch of really goopy samsaric stuff. But the goopy samsaric stuff can be got rid of. It can be moved away until it opens up, your mind opens up to its full potential, which would be the omniscience of a Buddha. So in that state, then, you don't take things to be as they appear to you to be, as they appear to your senses. You take them to be the way they actually are. Appearance emptiness, sound emptiness, smell emptiness, taste emptiness, thought emptiness, feeling emptiness, appearance emptiness on any level. So that's what the Buddha would actually see. That's how he would actually experience things. Okay? If there are any questions, now is the time, or we are going to dedicate the merit. Was that wishful thinking?
Just want to be ready.
Just checking. I'll give you a minute to see if you have any questions.
Maybe you should define samsara for new people.
Should I define samsara? Yeah? Okay. Samsara is the opposite of nirvana. Nirvana is beyond concept. Samsara is all about concepts. Samsara is translated in Tibetan as kora, which means, or korlo, which means a wheel, a turning, a cycle. And so we often translate samsara as cyclic existence. But samsara is a lot of different levels of that. Cyclic existence is you get born, you go through life, you don't become liberated from suffering and from this cycle. So you die because you have not exhausted all of your karma, because your mind will still have craving to be grounded again in a physical existence. You will take another rebirth, and you will be born again in some level or another. It could be an animal, it could be a god, it could be a human, it could be a hell being, it could be anything, right? So you're born again, you go through that lifetime, you don't get liberated, you don't see the reality of your experience, etc., etc., and you don't realize the true nature of mind. So you die, you go through the bardo again. Again, you still have karma, you still have craving, the mind, like lightning, wants to be grounded, the mind wants to be grounded in a physical existence. So you go through it again. We've all been through it thousands of times. So until you decide that it's time to get off the wheel, you'll keep on doing it. There would be nothing wrong with going around and around and around like that. There'd be absolutely nothing wrong with it if it wasn't that it's a state of suffering. Bodhisattvas take vows to go around and around over and over and over again as long as they can still benefit sentient beings. And that's one of the vows we take in our path. It's called the Bodhisattva vow. But because the Bodhisattva takes rebirth out of compassion for others and out of realization, they have a different kind of experience than we do. And hopefully is not about suffering, because there's no clinging to the self. You could not be on a level of Bodhisattva, but where you could choose your rebirth like that, if you had not already realized selflessness. And once that's realized, then there's no basis for suffering. There's no foundation for suffering. So the foundation for this whole samsara experience, again, is really believing and having that clinging and craving as a self, as a thinking that one is permanent, independent, and separate from others, rather than interdependent and totally connected. So that's the samsaric experience versus nirvana, which is nirvana is peace beyond concepts. Okay? Yeah.
Okay, so this house doesn't exist inherently, and neither do any houses or cars or actually people. So what does a Buddhist think about the significance of having a house, of this house, or someone having a home to live in, or the loss of someone's life, or how do those things...
Well, pick one.
Well, let's start with the house, this house, for example. Okay. This house versus being outside and or not having a place to gather, or just being...
Or not having a place to live.
Or not having a place to live.
Well, there are plenty of homeless people in Florida. You might want to ask them that question. It's important to take care of your body. If you don't take care of your body, you're not going to take care of your mind. I mean, that's what Siddhartha did. He went through all that asceticism and was destroying his body and realized that was not going to work. So you take care of yourself. You're not attached to the fact. You just, try to keep healthy, keep a roof over your head, eat good food so that you can practice and become enlightened. But, for those people who choose, and not many people do that anymore, to go off into the woods or find a cave and simply do without. I mean, I was lucky to have met Kala Rinpoche. He's probably one of the last people who ever did that. He left the monastery for 13 years. He just wandered around the Himalayas and meditated. Yogi Mincha Rinpoche did the same thing. and just came out of his, he did it for 4.5 years, and he just came back about, what, a year and a half ago, I think, he came back. But he just, he did a retreat as a wandering yogi, and yet he took no money with him, all he had was the clothes on his back, that was it. And he almost died in the first few months, but he made it through and just went off into the mountains in Nepal. So people can do that, but at the same time, if you're not at that level, it's best to have a house. Have shelter, have the refuge of doctors for illness, the refuge of a roof over your head for the rain and the hurricanes and things, you know. So, yeah. Okay?
Okay, just don't be attached.
Yeah, exactly. There was one siddha. There are all these mahasiddhas, 84 mahasiddhas in Asia, especially in India. And one of them was a king who had a vast collection of jewels. I mean, real, like, big chunks of gems, jewels. And so he had a guru, and the guru kept talking to him about non-attachment, and he said, well, I don't care about anything else. The palace can go, the country can go, everything can go, but I just can't stop my attachment to my jewels. And so the guru said, that's okay. He said, just use the jewels. Meditate on the jewels until you realize the emptiness of the jewels. And he did that, and he actually became a mahasiddha by meditating on the very thing that he was the most attached to. So, yeah, work it both ways. Have what you need. Don't be attached to it either way. Did you have another question?
Yes. Is the state of nirvana a state that is achieved in the physical state, or is it something that is past?
You mean, does it happen after you die?
Yes. Is it something that we can experience in the human state, or is it something that you need to be...
No, it is. Siddhartha did it. And many, many, many bodhisattvas attained full Buddhahood since then. And it's been 2,600 years, so many of them have. So you can definitely experience Buddhahood and become a full Buddha without dying. I think one of the reasons people have the idea that that can't happen is because it's taught that if you haven't attained enlightenment in this lifetime, at the time of death is the easiest time to attain full enlightenment. So that might, you know, but yeah, you definitely can, because it's a matter of realizing the nature of mind, which then you realize the nature of all phenomena, and you begin to, you know, to go that way. You get very high states of realization in this lifetime.
Just to clarify a term and not take up more time, a bodhisattva is a Buddha who is...
A bodhisattva?
Bodhisattva is a Buddha who has chosen to take rebirth.
Okay. Bodhisattva is, in Tibetan, Changchub Sempo, which really means hero or heroine of enlightenment. So it's the one who takes the vow as... We take two vows, aspiration, bodhicitta, and or bodhisattva vow, and application bodhisattva vow. And part of the application bodhisattva vow is that you will continue to help beings and come back or be born anywhere. You need to be reborn in order to help the most sentient beings. However, there's also there are also levels of bodhisattva that are levels of realization. And there are 10 of those bodhisattva levels before you reach Buddhahood.
This recording is a property of Open Awareness Buddhist Center. It is offered freely to individuals who seek the Dharma. If you wish to use all or part of this recording in a classroom setting, please email us at miamibuddhism@gmail.com.